Right, doing one of these unscripted talks, which is always a bit of a flight into the unknown. Quite unpredictable, really. Not quite sure what's going to come out of my mouth. Now, it so happens as for this talk, the unpredictability factor is actually raised a little bit. One reason is that I've got a cold, which always plays funny tricks with you, doesn't it? And you know, you take a bit of medication to stop the nose running, and so taking medication can play funny little tricks with you as well. So that makes it all slightly more unpredictable as to what's going to happen. Then, of course, we've all got end of term, that kind of end of term feeling, you know, last lecture of the season. The gift giving and so forth can make it all a little bit excitable. So that might make it a little bit more unpredictable. And then, of course, I don't know if you know, but Friday is a full moon. And for people that have become mindful, they will tell you that the full moon does have an effect on the mind. It has this effect of sort of deranging you slightly. As a consequence of that, I'm under the influence of the full moon as well. So that might make it even more unpredictable. And to cap it all, I decided that tonight's talk, I would talk about chaos. So I'm just asking for trouble. So I call tonight's talk The Butterfly Effect. And for the talk, I did a little bit of research to sort of try and get an idea of the sorts of things that have been happening in the course of 2008. Who could have expected or predicted the financial crisis? Who could have predicted the terrible events in Mumbai recently, the terrorist attacks? Who could have predicted that the US would elect a black president? And who could have predicted that the English national football team would start playing like Brazil? And of course, I know that some of you, we've all had an interesting year. What is it, the Chinese curse? May you live in interesting times? My goodness. I know that some of you have had to put up with bodily misfunctioning, disease, and having to have surgeries done, and broken bones and the like, none of which could have been predicted. Life is very unpredictable. And of course, that unpredictable, chaotic aspect of life can be very daunting and very frightening. An incident like the financial crisis can leave us feeling very insecure and feeling that we're on the edge somewhat. And we like to feel comfortable. We like to feel that there is order in the world. We like to feel that it's not going to go all terribly pear-shaped. Well, in actual fact, it's not, but we'll come to that. And so my talk was going to be about how the Buddha's teaching brings more harmony in one's life. It does, but I found as I was preparing the talk, an interesting paradox kept arising. Whenever I considered chaos, aspects of order began to emerge. And whenever I thought about order, aspects of chaos began to emerge. It seemed that you couldn't get free from one and just have the other. Whenever you had the one, the other seemed to come along too. My idea was, originally, that how to bring more control to your life, believing that that was the way to harmony. But as I thought more about the subject, I realised that just isn't possible. Harmony is not brought through more and more control. Harmony is brought through complete understanding of the nature of chaos and order. It's the balancing of chaos and order, that life is made up of chaos and order. You have the one, and the other comes along with it. And so really, that was the theme of the talk. So this paradox will keep on cropping up. If I do the talk properly, it will. It's interesting that We want life to be safe and secure. We want life to be ordered. It's only natural as human beings. In a sense, we want it to be predictable. Having things that are unpredictable can set us on edge somewhat. And we can often fall into the trap of thinking that by making life predictable, we'll have no suffering. But what happens if there's too much control? If life becomes too predictable, too controlled? Human nature then goes and seeks its opposite. A classic incident of what I'm talking about might be, say, revolution. You have an order, and then some people become fed up with that order. And so they create disharmony, they create disorder, in order to create a new order, the revolution. What happens if they succeed? They establish a new order, and then they don't want that order to be interfered with. And they become very frightened of the possibility of a counter-revolution, because other people don't want that order, they want another order. So in the attempt to gain order, there is always the fear arises of disorder and disharmony, an attempt to control. But there is always that fear of chaos underneath. What I'm trying to say here is that we always seek the opposite. If it becomes too controlled, too ordered, human nature is to muck things up again. If it becomes too mucky, too disharmonious, too disordered, then we try to create more order. And that's really the worldly way. Consider society as a whole. What is society? When we say that society is going through a bad patch, civilization is going through all these difficulties with terrorism and world, global financial catastrophe. When we talk about society, what is society? Society is made up of individuals. It's individuals that make up society. Can we control society? Can we ensure that the way we want to be society to be will come to be? Can we control society so that no suffering arises? There's no chaos. There's no difficulties. If society is made up of individuals, it means, therefore, that we have to be able to control all individuals. We have to be able to control the choices that they make. We have to be able to control whether they choose to act in greedy, hateful and confused ways, or whether they act in with renunciation, friendliness and wisdom. Can we do that? Is it possible to control everyone's minds? Would you put up with it? No, of course not. You would revolt. You wouldn't want to have your mind controlled in that way. The movements of society, the movements of civilization, the different periods it goes through, that we look back historically and say we went through this period and that period, it all stems from individuals' choices that they make. That being so, the movements that society goes through, the good times, the bad times, the difficult times, the wars, the prosperity, is actually all anatta. It's all non-self. It's not controllable. It moves as it will. It's chaotic to that extent. Buddhism would argue that you can't control society in the way, essentially, that we try. The Buddha said, by oneself is evil done. By oneself is one defiled. By oneself is evil left undone. By oneself is one purified. Purity and impurity depend on oneself. No one can purify another. It is possible to find order and harmony within our own lives. We do it by taking personal responsibility. But there's a very interesting correlation to this. I'd like to use the illustration that chaos theory, when it was first evolved, came up with. Now, chaos theory basically states that a small event can have a major influence on a major event. And they use the example of the butterfly effect. I'm sure most people are familiar with it, that the flapping of a butterfly's wing, being a small event, becomes part of a chain reaction that eventually has the impact to change the direction of a tornado. Now, it doesn't state that it causes a tornado, some people fall into that trap, but it can change the course substantially, change the course of a tornado. If we take personal responsibility for our lives, for the actions that we perform, this butterfly effect also takes place. As an illustration of this, and try get across the point I'm trying to make here, when I was looking at things to talk about in review, I came across a recent story of, I don't know all the facts, but apparently there are two comedians on the radio who made some kind of prank on somebody's answer phone. And it was just a childish prank, but it got aired. And it was just like this small little event, and yet it took on this massive, incredibly massive proportions, where I think in the end two people had to resign from their jobs and another one was suspended and questions were asked in Parliament and there's a whole thing going down. Is that not an example of the butterfly effect in operation? Now, the reason I'm mentioning this is that all of us can bring harmony to society. And it works on the same basic principle. If we take responsibility for our lives and the chaos within our own minds and our lives and try to bring order, then that harmony that we produce within will be reflected without. And we can't say where our actions, the knock-on effects of our actions, may go. We don't know the size of the tornado we may be able to change the direction of through our actions. Another way of stating what I'm talking about is simply the law of karma. The Buddha says that actions have results. As an illustration of this, the financial crisis. It's apparently, a lot of people are suggesting that the way to get out of the financial crisis is to borrow more so that you can spend more. Which, now, I'm not political, I don't want to get involved in any politics, but isn't that what caused the problem in the first place? What about generosity? The Buddha maintained that material wealth could be obtained through being generous. They probably don't talk about that in Parliament very much, but perhaps that's a way to ensure order, a way to free yourself from the worries and the chaos of falling into chaos, material chaos, is to practice generosity and find out whether or not it does bring you material well-being and peace of mind. Now, there's a paradox here, because the law of karma is clearly stating that there is order to our actions. That our actions produce results. So that if we act generously, it will yield wealth for us. But there's also a chaotic aspect, because the results will only accrue when the supporting conditions exist. So that's the rub with using the karma as your guide, is you cannot say when the results will accrue. However, if you practice it, you will find out experientially whether or not it's the case. But when the results arise is somewhat chaotic, in that it depends on the supporting conditions being there. How do we bring harmony? If we are experiencing a lot of chaos in our lives, how do we bring harmony? How do we find peace of mind? How do we free ourselves from suffering? The Buddha said there is only one way to the freedom of suffering, and that is to practice mindfulness. Observation, awareness of our inner world will yield very positive results. It's through being mindful that we come to understand the order and the processes that operate within us and in the world. To try and illustrate this for you, to give an idea of what I'm trying to say, scientists came up with what they called a random event generator, or a REG for short. A random event generator is a little handheld machine that produces pulses in completely random sequences. Don't ask what the technology is, I really don't understand it. But the effect is that you have as random a series of pulses being produced again and again at really, really high speeds. And what they found is that if they put this, they're able to keep a log of these random impulses and set it down in front of people and ask people to be aware of this random event generator, to bring it into mind, to be mindful of it, really. And they recorded the results and found that whenever human consciousness was brought to bear on the random event generator, the randomness of the impulses gave way to recognizable, ordered patterns. Do you follow what I'm trying to say here? Thank goodness. And essentially what they found is that when you bring consciousness to bear on the random event generator, it produces, the randomness comes into recognizable shapes and patterns. And that's the concept I wanted to get over about understanding why it is that we create chaos in our own lives. That the mind has this natural tendency towards order. It wants to order. That's what mind does. Part of its processing is to make sense of this whole whirligig of experience. As an example, you wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning, you're startled by some sound outside in the garden. What's the first thing the mind does? It says, what's that? It wants a label. It wants to come out of chaos and come into order. And so you look out the window and you find that the cat's managed to get the dustbin over and it's rooting its way through your dustbin, making a right old mess. But you prefer that because you can label it, so that you can go back to bed and think, oh, clear that up in the morning. But because you've got a label, you've come out of a chaotic situation, potentially chaotic situation, and you've found order. That's what the mind does. Now, when we come to meditation and practicing the mindful way, we find, generally speaking, when we first start, that the mind is chaotic, apparently uncontrollable. All kinds of thoughts and feelings, emotions, views, memories, all piling in there, all apparently without any rhyme or reason. It's a very uncontrollable state. Now, of course, what we ask people to do is to label their experience, to turn consciousness towards the contents of our minds in order to make sense of what's going on. Because although it appears that it's chaotic, actually, it's all operating with cause and effect. It's all operating through processes and order that is identifiable and understandable by anyone who cares to look. But that process of ordering, you have to turn consciousness to actually look at what's going on in mind and body, which is why we practice mindfulness. is to begin the process of ordering what's going on so it's understandable, so we're not confused. Establishing mindfulness isn't easy. One of the reasons it isn't easy is because we don't understand how mind and body actually operate. We may well have constructed lives that have a fair amount of confusion and chaos already in them. One of the things we have to do is to create supporting conditions that are conducive to the development of mindfulness. If you find that mindfulness is difficult to establish, Here's one way of establishing some conducive supporting conditions. Keeping your home and your appearance impeccably. Keeping your home tidy and clean. Keeping your appearance looking tidy and clean. Why would that be? Well, if you consider when you come to the centre, it's kept impeccably. There's simplicity, there's order. Why would that be? The internal and the external mirror one another. If somebody has a confused outer world, like their house is very confused, clothes everywhere, that sort of thing, can only find one of your shoes, that kind of thing, then it's suggestive that your inner world is confused. Yeah? Because the two just mirror one another. If you find that your outer world is ordered, and you keep your outer world ordered, then that's suggestive that your inner world is ordered also, because the two just reflect one another. Yeah, does it make sense? Good. So if you find that your life is chaotic, bring some order to it by ordering your environment. You'll find that will help to order your mind at any given time. So you create a conducive supporting condition in that way. But a warning here, beware of too much order. I know somebody that I used to work with who had a obsessive compulsive disorder, and it manifested itself as in having to keep her home immaculately tidy. Not one speck of dust was allowed. I mean, you didn't want to sit down on the settee just in case you sort of creased it or anything, you know, because it would be terrible. She would come and straighten it out. So you have that paradox again. She had gone so far into order that it had become a disorder. Yeah. So you have to keep a balance. Another supporting condition, keeping precepts, will help to bring order and balance and harmony to one's life. I like to talk about the fifth precept, which is drink, essentially. Drink and mind-altering drugs. Drinking and mind-altering drugs do tend towards confusion. If someone gets heavily involved with drink, for instance, there is often an underlying cause, which is an attempt to keep a lid on the chaos in their lives. So by drinking, the resentments, the anger, the painful feelings that have been generated, by drinking you can temporarily put the lid on them. You can experience a freedom from that chaos temporarily. And I have to say, I don't actually have to put antidepressants in the same category here. Because antidepressants, even though that they've been prescribed by a doctor, they're still actually doing the same thing. They're an attempt to put the lid on the chaos so you don't have to deal with it for the time being. But of course, all these things are very temporary. What happens if somebody keeps on putting the lid down through drink or drugs is that they become dependent upon those things. and it becomes very, very dangerous. And of course, at no time is the chaotic nature of their lives, the resentments, the angers, and so forth, being looked at. As a consequence, someone can become rotten inside. Therefore, it's for people who are intent on mindfulness practice, heavy drinking is, of course, out of the question. If it's, because most of the time, heavy drinking is about blotting out the things you don't want to look at. But a word of warning. You can also go too far the other way. The control freak, who never ever drinks under any circumstances. Christmas is upon us. We'll be visiting family, no doubt. People who don't meditate, people who have no interest in the subject. Are we to stand on one side and sort of say, no, I'm not even going to toast Christmas, I'm not even going to, no. You become the most unpopular person at the party very, very quickly. So there's a balance to be struck, of course. Now, of course, this is a message to the control freaks, the libertines. You need to sort of like not listen to this bit. Brother Paul said, that's not what I mean. There has to be a balance, yeah? What I think I'm getting at here is you have to be willing to turn around and look at the chaos inside. That's the message here. That's the underlying theme I'm trying to get at, is that chaos isn't bad news. It's not that chaos is wrong, just as it's misunderstood. There's a middle way where, say, in a meditation, you sit down and you allow whatever wants to come into the mind to come in, which is an acceptance of the chaotic nature of your mind. You can't predict what it is that's going to come up. The idea is that you don't try to control it in that way. Yes, of course, we have to learn how to keep the mind steady, which is why we practice repeatedly looking at the breath. Yeah? So that's your object to look at. But again and again and again and again, the mind is taken away. It's taken away into daydream, it's taken away into resentment, it's taken away into listening to church bells, it's taken away in all kinds of different ways, and we learn to keep bringing it back. But the object of the exercise is to slowly learn just to accept whatever wants to come into the mind, which means accepting chaos completely. Yeah? What happens if you do that? What happens is, because there's no resistance to whatever comes into the mind, there's no fear of what it is that's going to come into the mind, paradoxically, even though you've allowed chaos in, you find that there's perfect harmony, there's perfect order. And you find, experientially, that it is so that the problem is not the chaos, because the chaos is actually very, very ordered. The problem is always the resistance to what's going on. It's the resistance that sends somebody into heavy drinking, for instance. It's the resistance to the chaos that is the problem. The actual mental and physical phenomena that arise and pass away in the meditation is simply that. And what happens is somebody slowly learns this wonderful, wonderfully subtle art of just remaining in the moment, resting in the moment, watching things arising and passing away, they find that there is a discernible order to the chaos. Because there's a sense, working sense base, and there's some kind of object, sense consciousness arises. So if there is a visible object, and if there is a working eye, eye consciousness arises. Seeing arises. They see quite clearly that the coming together of the three is sense contact. And conditioned by the sense contact arises some kind of feeling. And in response to the feeling, there is some kind of response to that feeling. Now, if there is craving and hatred in the mind, that produces suffering. If there is no craving and hatred in the mind, that does not produce suffering. So, this apparent chaos is actually perfectly ordered. It's perfectly obvious to the practicing meditator that there isn't a problem. The problem is only the resistance to what we find. And I appreciate that's quite a big problem, and that's why we walk the Buddhist path. But essentially, you find that the chaos was only apparent. There was this perfect order. Now, interestingly, if somebody does bring their mind to order, where they are just able to sit and rest in the moment and just experience whatever's going on and see its nature to arise and pass away, the mind becomes very still, very happy, very interested, very one-pointed. And it's at those times some very unexpected things can occur. Like, for instance, there was one meditator who reached this lovely space, and in the mind's eye, a being appeared. Now, it wasn't an image of a being that appeared. This meditator said that it was a being, a real being, someone that they could converse with on the mental level. The being, they discovered as they were looking at it, was giving out a message of unconditional love and welcome. And the meditator said that she felt perfectly at ease with this being. As she looked at this being, a few interesting facts began to emerge. Firstly, she saw that this being was androgynous. God, this has got your attention, hasn't it? The being was neither male nor female. If she looked at this being one way, then he looked male. If she looked at him another way, then she looked female. And another interesting fact emerged. She realised that she was looking at her own face. It was her. Which is rather surprising. But interestingly, it was a refined image. Well, it wasn't a refined image, it was a refined version of her. So the spots were missing. the crooked teeth were missing. Whatever it might be that she, when she looked in the mirror, she found so horrible about herself. It was a refined version of herself. Now, this is all too much for her, of course. She came out of that concentrated state, later went to see her teacher, and her teacher advised her, what you've seen there is your mental body. And it is possible to enter that mental body and then begin to traverse the psychic realms in that body. You couldn't make it up, could you? So from having reached this beautiful, harmonious place, how could you predict that something like that would happen? This is the nature of the mind when you do bring it to this lovely, ordered, harmonious place. Something totally unpredictable occurs. Now, of course, we have to be careful here not to begin to grasp after such experiences ourselves. Because if we do, what have we started to do? We've started to try and control and manipulate the meditation. Whereas the experience actually arose from allowing the experience, the meditation, to go wherever it wanted. And just to note it, label it, be mindful of it. The mind came to an ordered state, and then something out of the ordinary occurred. So we have to be careful of not creating expectations either from our own experiences or hearing other people's experiences, because we immediately start going down the control route, which is not where we want to be with the meditation. But do we meditate for these psychic experiences to occur, or do we meditate for another reason? Here at the House of Inner Tranquility, we meditate to gain wisdom. Wisdom, essentially, into chaos and order. I've talked a little bit about conditionality in terms of, say, the butterfly effect. When somebody reaches this lovely point of stillness and they're watching things arise and pass away, you find that you see in your experience that there are always multiple causes for multiple effects. There is like a net of interrelatedness. And that's how experience is actually created moment by moment. There's multiple causes for multiple effects. The meditator sees, for instance, that there is a serial arising of phenomena moment by moment. One thing arises and it's replaced with something else that arises and it's replaced with something else that arises. It might be a thought, sound, touch, smell, memory, worry, fear, desire. It could be anything, one after another, when you've got to this point where you're not controlling, you're just watching. Now this is an incredible thing to see, because it's very life-affirming. Because you see that there is this natural flow and order to life, and that one thing is replaced by another, and life is continuing all the time, and there's this wonderful sense of order. At a later stage in the meditation, the meditator sees that there's this serial dissolution, moment by moment, things disappearing again and again and again. At this stage, the meditator feels fear and misery and disgust. They find it extremely difficult to accept. Why? Because they see that it's so chaotic. It's not controllable. It has no owner. And it's just dissolving moment by moment over and over again. So the meditator sees in real terms that there is order when there is chaos. And they're looking at it. They're looking at the actual fabric of existence as it arises and passes away moment by moment. And as time goes on and the experience deepens and you see clearly that's the way it is, over time an equanimity begins to emerge, because you reach a point of acceptance of both the chaos and the order, and you're no longer seeking to control either. So there's this perfect acceptance of life, because life contains both chaos and order. If you take it far enough, you reach a point where you realise that there is a perfect order. There has always been a perfect order. There has never been a time when there has not been perfect order. This point is what people describe as enlightenment. One of the main, it seems to me, one of the main components of the realization is that life is totally predictable, because it runs along laws that are observable. You can see conditionality, you can see the arising and passing away of phenomena, you can actually see how it's constructed, how it's put together moment by moment. And yet at the same time, you see that life is totally unpredictable. No, exactly, it's exactly that. You cannot control it. You sit in a meditation, you don't know what's going to happen next. If you can generate that kind of attitude to the meditation, which says, I wonder what's going to happen next, you get out of the idea that you're doing something to control it, and you're wanting to control your experience. Life is completely unpredictable. And yet it operates along completely observable lines, a complete order which is observable. So in a sense you have absolute chaos and absolute order. The enlightened mind sees that life is both utterly predictable and completely unpredictable at the same time. Now, you ask yourself, how is that possible? At the same time, the enlightened mind is beyond both chaos and order. And it's the point at which you're able to transcend all this arising and passing away and conditionality, and you're able to see that the rules that govern life are so perfect that what they produce is never ever repeated. That experience is it's like trying to walk twice, put your foot twice in the same river. You can't do it. Life never repeats itself. But then I have to contradict myself and say that there is patterns, observable patterns, which are eternally true. What I'm trying to get at is that there is absolute chaos and absolute order at the same time, and that's what life's like. Life is like that. That is what life is. It's perfect. Chaos and perfect order, all at the same time, and yet the enlightened mind is completely free of it, beyond it. Once again, I've gone way too long and confused you all terribly, but that's your problem. I think if I wanted to reaffirm one point, it's the one about the butterfly effect, that although the things that you hear on the TV and the way the world appears to be so at times so chaotic and uncertain, if you apply the butterfly effect and you choose to live in certain ways, then you don't know how those actions will reverberate and how they may help society. But the Buddha could put it better than I could, and he put it like this: better it is to live one day virtuous and meditative than to live 100 years immoral and uncontrolled. Better it is to live one day wise and meditative than to live 100 years foolish and uncontrolled. Better it is to live one day strenuous and resolute than to live 100 years sluggish and dissipated. Better it is to live one day seeing the rise and fall of things than to live 100 years without ever seeing the rise and fall of things. Better it is to live one day seeing the supreme truth than to live 100 years without ever seeing the supreme truth.